This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Blue sky smiling at me. Nothing but blue sky do I see.
Excuse me, do you mind if I turn your blue skies white? Why spend all that money on wind farms and insulation? Keep on driving, brothers and sisters, because big science is going to fix global warming for you.
Since the beginning of time, man has yearned to destroy the sun. I will do the next best thing. Block it out.
While they talk up a new Manhattan project to block out the sun, it's another year of multi-billion dollar profits for the coal and oil industries. Stall, 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 while the money rolls in. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In this program, we'll dig deep into geoengineering, the industrialization of the climate. You'll hear top climate scientist Alan Robach. He's got a laundry list of reasons why trying to control the climate may not be such a good idea. Diana Bronson of the Etc. Group joins us to counter the academies and the think tanks that are pushing this stuff. You won't hear Bjorn Lomborg, the self-styled skeptical environmentalist, now pushing projects to reduce the sun's rays reaching Earth. I invited Mr. Lomborg to do an interview, but he was too busy. And I believe he's busy. Lomborg has op-eds and interviews going into all the major media. He doesn't need Radio EcoShock. Newsweek and Time magazine love him. Newspapers print his words uncritically. In early September, Lomborg was at the White House to meet Joe Aldi, special assistant to the president for energy and the environment. No doubt he's pushing geoengineering. Because Bjorn Lomborg knows the major governments of the world, the IPCC and all those other carbon cutters, are on the wrong track. Lomborg doesn't dispute that rapid global warming is upon us, but cutting greenhouse gas emissions is much too expensive, he says, citing a report written for his organization, which is called the Copenhagen Consensus. Bjorn Lomborg has a half dozen good reasons why we should just keep on burning gas and oil and coal. Say what? Known for his book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, Lomborg has summoned elite economists to determine the world's priority needs. Wonder of wonders, climate change is way down that list, they say, compared to treating tropical diseases and working on poverty. Let's do that first, and big American corporate donors like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are glad to take his advice. No need to upset ExxonMobil or Peabody Coal. Now Lomborg has a report on geoengineering, which he commissioned. He calls it science, others disagree. Let's go to one of the prime contributors from the blog realclimate.org, world-famous climate scientist Alan Robach. Anyone can be a blogger, but not everyone is a real climate scientist. Dr. Alan Robach is an environmental professor at Rutgers University. He's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He did participate in the Nobel-winning 2007 report of the IPCC. Dr. Robach, you've gathered a list of 20 reasons at one point why geoengineering might not be such a good idea. Now we know the climate is already in trouble and nobody has reduced their carbon emissions. Have you changed your mind?
I've been looking at the items on my list and I've canceled out a couple of them upon further investigation, but I've added one to the list. So my list now has 17 reasons why geoengineering might be a bad idea, 6 reasons why it might be a good idea. And to make decisions about whether indeed to proceed, we need to evaluate and study each of these issues in much more detail and quantify them to see how important they are.
Let's get into the solution now popularized in the media by Bjorn Lomborg, the Danish political specialist who created the so-called Climate Consensus Center. Their report on geoengineering says we can make clouds whiter really cheaply to cool the planet. What is your response to their report by J. Eric Bickel and Lee Lane?
I wouldn't say they've popularized it. I'd just say that they issued this report, which was not peer-reviewed, not checked by other experts. I wrote a comment on it on the realclimate.org website, which is a website done by real scientists, as you mentioned. And I pointed out that theirs is a purely economic analysis and looking at the costs of actually implementing schemes to make clouds brighter near the surface of the Earth or to put particles up in the stratosphere to block out the sun. And they're comparing that to the costs of reducing carbon dioxide emissions and the benefits of avoiding climate change. But they ignore a huge number of potential risks and the costs associated with them. And by ignoring a large part of the problem, they get a completely erroneous ratio of cost benefit to cost for doing this.
And just out of personal curiosity, would it actually make the sky whiter? Would I lose my blue skies and end up with white skies?
Yes, that's number four on my list.
Okay. All right, well then we have...
How white the skies would be requires more research, and it depends on... First of all, we should sort of define what we mean by geoengineering. These schemes to reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth, so-called solar radiation management. I think that's a great term because it sounds so audacious that we can manage solar radiation. So I like to use it because it sounds ridiculous. But there are two schemes that have been proposed. One is to make clouds brighter near the surface by putting particles into them. That wouldn't make the skies in the upper atmosphere white at all. You'd still have blue skies above these clouds. The other scheme is to actually put particles up in the stratosphere to scatter sunlight, just like volcanic eruptions do. That would make the skies whiter. And to determine how white it would be, we need to know what types of particles, what their sizes would be, and where they would be in the sky, what time of year, what latitude, and then we could actually calculate what the sky would look like. And on my list of things to do is to turn this over to some psychologists who can evaluate how that makes people feel and whether that really depresses people. This blue color of the sky is something that our human race has lived with for many, many generations, and it's something that makes us feel good, and so to just eliminate it might really have important psychological effects. We know that in places where it's gray and dreary in the winter, like Seattle, the suicide rate goes up, so it's not something just to throw away. It really needs more evaluation along with all the other things on my list.
Well, I know how it makes me feel. It makes me feel angry just to think about it, but there you go. Well, we have a second more serious entry with the press release and a 100-page report from the Royal Society now in Britain. It also seems to champion the development of more geoengineering. What do you make of that?
I wouldn't say it exactly like that. What they say is we need more research in geoengineering. They don't say we need to do geoengineering. They say we need to understand it more, and I completely agree with that. The American Meteorological Society has also issued a policy statement about geoengineering saying the same thing, that if policymakers are considering this action to save us from global warming, they want to see, well, nobody advocates actually doing it unless there's a planetary emergency, unless things get out of hand and mitigation doesn't work. And so, do you have this plan B in your back pocket? That's the question. Is there anything in your pocket or not? And so in order to answer that question, we really need a lot more work. And that's what both the Royal Society and the American Meteorological Society here have advocated.
Well, Alan Robach, you've written about the things that worry about geoengineering, and I know we won't have time to go through all of your reasons, but I'd like to give you some time now, as long as you like, if you could outline some of the biggest reasons to be cautious about technological fixes to the climate disruption problem.
Well, I've looked at the scheme to put particles in the stratosphere, and I've worked on the effects of volcanic eruptions on climate my whole career, and so first of all, we don't know how to do it. There are ideas, speculations using airplanes or artillery, but nobody's demonstrated that it could be done. And so a lot more work needs to go in just to the technology to see whether it actually can be done in a practical sense. But if it could, then we learn from volcanic eruptions that when you block out the sun, it cools the land more than the ocean. It doesn't cool the earth evenly. And in the summer, this temperature contrast between the continents and the ocean drives the monsoon circulation and produces rain over Asia and Africa, and farmers use that rain for agriculture. with geoengineering, this temperature contrast would be less, the land wouldn't heat up as much, and the monsoon would be weaker, and there would be less rain. We find that in our climate model simulations. We also find that in observations, it's happened after large volcanic eruptions in the past. And so the food supply for a couple billion people that live in India and China and the rest of Asia is of great concern. And we don't know whether it would have a large effect or a small effect. It needs more evaluation with specific scenarios of geoengineering and different climate models that do things differently to compare to see whether this result is robust. But that's one concern. Another concern is that if you are trying to cool the climate, you will do nothing about the half of the CO2 that goes into the ocean every year that we put in. It makes the ocean more acidic and destroys coral. And so that wouldn't address that part of the problem at all. We also know that when you put particles in the stratosphere, they serve as surfaces for reactions that release chlorine and destroy ozone. This happens every year in the spring around Antarctica, and after volcanic eruptions, it happens at lower latitudes because of the chlorofluorocarbons, the freons that we've been putting up for decades. Although we're no longer emitting them, they're still going to last for many more decades, and so calculations have shown that geoengineering by stratospheric particles would cause enhanced ozone depletion and more ultraviolet radiation. One of the main ways that we're trying to solve the problem of global warming is to produce electricity without burning fossil fuels, and one of those is solar power. The most efficient way to use solar power is to focus the sunlight and boil water or concentrate it on a solar photovoltaic system. But if you put particles in the stratosphere, you'll have a lot more diffuse light. That's what makes the sky white, and much less direct light. And so that would really cut down on solar power. After the Pinatubo eruption in 1991, solar power from these systems in California that already exist was cut by 30% in the summer. Then there's a whole bunch of other things on the list. If it was stopped immediately by society losing the means or the will to do it, you'd get rapid warming as the particles came out of the atmosphere in the next year or so. Much more rapid climate change than you'd get if you'd done nothing. And sometimes it's the rate of change of climate that's much more important than the absolute amount because we slowly adjust. Now, you know, Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. There's unknown unknowns. We don't know what we don't know. There could be human errors. There could also be unexpected consequences. And so we're always taking a chance by using something, this technological fix. It's easy to think of examples of technological systems that don't work properly. I mean, everybody that drove their car today probably wore a seatbelt, not because they expected to have an accident, but because just in case. So we know that we all intimately understand that concept. We all have insurance on our houses, so we understand that there can be mistakes. Now, who would be actually doing this? Would it be the U.S. military? Would it be ExxonMobil Geoengineering Corporation? There are concerns about who would be in control and whose interests they would have at heart, and would they be trusted by people in our country and the rest of the world? Let's assume that actually it could work, though. Let's assume, what if you actually could control the climate? Whose hand would be on the thermostat? Who would decide what the planetary temperature should be and whether we've actually reached a planetary emergency? There are no international governance mechanisms to control that. What if Russia and Canada wanted it a couple degrees warmer and India wanted it a couple degrees cooler? Who's going to decide? Will there be geoengineering wars? And, you know, astronomers spend billions of dollars to put these fancy observatories on tops of mountains like in Chile and Hawaii to get above most of the gook in the atmosphere so they can see the stars more clearly. If we end up putting a permanent layer of particles above these astronomical observatories, it would really have a huge effect on their operations. I don't think they would be happy with that. So I'll stop there.
Is there a lot of debate going on between our top climate scientists on whether we should go ahead with this? I mean, one of the points that you brought up is,
it depends what you mean by going ahead. I don't think there's much debate at all that we should go ahead with research to try and figure out if it could work and how it would work. People are doing this already, even though there has been no organized research program sponsored by the U.S. or British or any other governments. I expect that to appear sometime soon, and I have a research grant from National Science Foundation to study this. And so I don't think there's much debate about whether we should do the research. Some people say we shouldn't because it's evil, or that once you start developing it, you can't stop it from being used. But I don't think there's much debate about research. There are some people that are already advocating actually implementing it, that we're going to have a planetary emergency. As you said, there's no mitigation yet, and so we're going to have to use it eventually, and we might as well get started and do some small-scale experiments. And so there is a lot of controversy about whether you should ever actually do the experiment in the atmosphere and what it should consist of. But as far as actually learning more about it, I don't think there's much debate. I was on the American Meteorological Society committee that wrote the statement, and there was a lot of interaction, discussion among the people, but it was mainly about wording. It was not about the fundamental issue of whether we should recommend more research.
Well, I do worry about the research. It seems we got our nuclear knowledge, and we ended up making mass murder weapons out of it. And this climate control could be used as a military weapon. I think that was one of your points originally. And we've hardly had a technology as humans that we haven't that we've been able to resist using. It does worry me.
Yeah, well, but nuclear bombs were built to be used as weapons. That was the fundamental goal. Later on, they said, well, maybe we could use it for nuclear power and make it look, get some benefit out of it, but it was specifically designed as a weapon. So this is not specifically being designed as a weapon, and whether it could actually be used as a weapon or not is really an issue, because could you actually control where it would be? It looks like, from our understanding, that you can put particles in the stratosphere, but the wind blows them around the world, and you can't change the climate in one specific place and not in another place. And so, indeed, any knowledge can be used for evil. So that's the problem with knowledge. I mean, should you try and make your research as useless as possible so nobody could use it for good or evil? It's not specific to this or anything else. I mean, I think hand in hand with knowledge, we have to give some guidance and look at the clearly give the negative as well as the positive aspects of it so people can decide. I mean, I was involved in nuclear winter research and still am, the climatic effects of nuclear war, which is the biggest threat to the planet from humans, not climate change, not global warming, from greenhouse gases. And I'm convinced that our explaining the possible consequences on climate of the use of weapons helped end the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. It made people start looking at how crazy it was to continue to add more and more weapons and how dangerous it would be to use them. You couldn't even use them. And so if we educate people about the consequences, then they can make informed decisions.
Well, I'm also a bit suspicious, because I find there seems to be two different bodies who are proposing more research into this. One is scientists who I would recognize, you know, like James Lovelock, who are saying we should do more research into geoengineering. But another seems to be coming from right-wing lobby groups, from even perhaps people funded by the oil industry, who seem to be suggesting, well, sure, we can keep on burning carbon. We may not even need to do very much at Copenhagen, because we'll just geoengineer our way out of it, the big technical fix.
Yeah, well, that's a concern of mine, too. And I see these right-wing groups who, up until very recently, claimed global warming didn't exist. There was no problem. Now they're already suggesting a solution to a problem they claim doesn't exist. And as you said, there's this moral hazard problem. The prospect of geoengineering working would reduce the drive for mitigation. Not that there's much of a drive for mitigation anyway. The U.S. Has done nothing over the last 10 years, and finally we have a president and a Congress who wants to do something about it. They're still fighting huge interests in the energy industry, who still has lots of control about whether that we can actually reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. And until the U.S. starts to lead, the rest of the world has an excuse not to do anything. And so if the prospect of geoengineering working appears to be real, it might lessen the drive for mitigation. But there are no responsible scientists saying that it should be geoengineering instead of mitigation. We all say that we have to do mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions first, And then if we can't do it fast enough, maybe temporarily we would have to cool the climate until we get the climate under control by mitigation and by taking the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And so it depends exactly how you say it, but there are people that are advocating geoengineering instead of mitigation. But those are sort of crackpots and not serious scientists advocating that. And so some people get confused by advocating geoengineering research as compared to advocating geoengineering. And so it has to be explained clearly to people.
And is it possible to test it without risking damaging the climate?
It depends which type of geoengineering you're talking about. The idea of putting particles into clouds and making them brighter can be tested on a small scale. You can choose a small area of the ocean, a remote area, and you can see if you can pump particles in and for an hour or a day and see how clouds respond and stop, and the effect will dissipate. That part of it can be tested. But putting particles in the stratosphere can't be tested on a small scale, even though some people claim that it can, because if you put a small amount of particles in the stratosphere, the winds will blow them around the world and dissipate them and diffuse them, and whatever effect they have on sunlight will be very small, and you wouldn't be able to measure it against the background of natural variability of the weather and climate, the chaotic nature of the atmosphere. In fact, nature has done this experiment for us a couple times the last couple years. The Sarachev volcano in Alaska erupted earlier this summer, putting about 1 teragram of SO2 into the stratosphere. That's about 1/20th of the amount of the big eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991, which did have a measurable effect on climate. The Sarachev eruption nobody's been able to measure any impact on climate. It was a pretty large amount, but it was dissipated quickly. Last year, the Kasatochi volcano in Alaska erupted 1.5 teragrams of SO2. Again, no detectable effect, even though we could see the cloud. And so in order to do an experiment that would be large enough to see the effect, the signal versus the noise, you'd have to either do a huge amount for a short period of time or a small amount, but for a long period of time. And by then, you're actually doing the geoengineering. So I think experimenting in climate models in computer programs that have been tested by their ability to explain what's happened in the past, by their ability to model the effects of volcanic eruptions, is the way to test it now, not to do it in the real world, because we should do as much theoretical testing as we can before we actually do any in-situ tests.
Well, you touched on my final objection, as it were, which is that it seems like this is being proposed and developed by the elite, shall we say, in the developed world, and we have no mechanism for the average person in Chile, for example, to vote or decide. There's no global voting system where humanity can decide whether to change the sky. And I just find that a real fundamental problem, and I know that some people in developing countries see the same way.
Well, first of all, I would think that a lot of people in Chile would not say that they're a developing country. That's a pretty developed country. But second of all, the AMS statement, the American Meteorological Society statement, advocates research not just in climate, but in governance. And so one of the 3 points that we make is that we need to research moral issues and governance issues and develop a new system to make decisions like that. And so we're advocating exactly that, trying to figure out how to make those decisions should the time come. And so you're right, there is no mechanism now. On the other hand, it's the rich countries that produced the problem of global warming in the first place, and so it should be incumbent on them to try and help find a solution, but it should be the whole world deciding. There's another issue. Do we really have the right to control the climate? And we're just one species. We have the right to control it for all the rest of the species on the planet. I mean, we're already having huge impacts inadvertently. We're not trying to change the climate. We're trying to drive our cars and cook our food and turn on lights. But now that we recognize that, we have the right to continue to do that. So there's a lot of these philosophical moral issues that have to be addressed, which aren't being addressed either. The fundamental problem is that people make lots of money with business as usual by selling products that pollute the atmosphere with no sewerage charge, and we don't pay the actual cost of them. And they've gotten in the U.S., for example, the cost of gasoline should be $10, $15 a gallon if you want to pay for the military to bring in the fuel, if you want to pay for the environmental costs, and they've been successful at getting those costs paid separately without a connection to the use of the fuel. And so until we have an increase in the price of carbon of emitting it, there won't be much of a move on mitigation, and there are huge industrial interests in not changing that. So that's going to be the big fight.
Well, as we wrap up, can you give us a short summary that an ordinary citizen might take home about this debate for now?
Yeah, first of all, humans are, with their pollution, are causing global warming, are causing climate change. It might be hard to imagine, but the largest cause, there are many causes of climate change, including the sun and volcanic eruptions, but right now, what we put in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels is the most important cause of climate change. And it's going to be bad for us. There's a lot of more losers than winners. And so the most important thing we have to do is to stop emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by using energy more efficiently and by generating energy with solar and wind power that doesn't produce CO2. That's the most important thing. If at some point in the future climate gets out of control and some future governance mechanism determines that we have a planetary emergency, we should know whether it's possible by some much cheaper method to actually cool off the planet, and would those mechanisms do more good than harm? And we don't know that yet, so we really need research just to know whether we can do that or not.
Our guest has been Alan Robach. Find more of his writing at the blog where real scientists speak, realclimate.org, or just Google Alan Robach, R-O-B-O-C-K, and you'll get his homepage top of the pile. Alan, thank you so much for giving us your valuable time and insight.
My pleasure.
Alan Robach has posted a rebuttal of Bjorn Lomborg's latest attempt at climate scientist at realclimate.org. Just type in Lomborg, L-O-M-B-O-R-G, in the Real Climate search box.
Ah, perpetual twilight, bathed in the glow of Burns brand electricity.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You've got our geoengineering special. If you've just tuned in, you can always download the full program from our free website, ecoshock.org. Geoengineering, humans trying to run planetary systems, in this case, the climate. In an article in the British newspaper The Telegraph on August 7, 2009, Bjorn Lomborg claims it is way cheaper to block off the sun than to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Lomborg isn't a climate denier. He agrees we're in trouble. He's a climate delayer, with almost every reason an oil executive could think of to wait a little longer before pricing carbon, capping emissions, or going to sustainable energy. Lomborg is not trained in climate science. His degree is political science. But Lomborg is no longer a lone voice. Suddenly, all sorts of people are on the geoengineering bandwagon. The British Royal Society released a 100-page report on getting science going for climate manipulation. It's called Geoengineering the Climate, Science, Governance, and Uncertainty, released in September 2009. The American Meteorological Society just released a similar report, so it's not just Bjorn Lomborg and the right-wing think tanks who promote his work. I'll get into the rumors of a super strategy to derail climate talks in a minute. First, we need to hear from Diana.
When she's on her best behavior, don't be tempted by her favors. Never turn your back.
Bronson from the Etc. Group has some important warnings about the rush to geoengineering. Diana, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, as you know, the so-called skeptical environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg, he's pushing a program of cloud ships to block out the sun and thus cool the earth. He says that will only cost $9 billion annually instead of the $250 billion it might cost to switch to a real zero-emissions economy. Does geoengineering sound like a good deal to you?
We're very concerned about geoengineering, and the sad thing is that there's voices that are a lot more credible than Bjorn Lomborg who are advancing these ideas right now.
Yeah, we've got the Royal Society with big names like James Lovelock and Lord Martin Rees. They've got a press release out August 28th, 2009, saying we've got to develop geoengineering as a plan B. I guess they figure we'll just keep on burning fossil fuels past the dangerous point. What can we say about this?
Well, there's a good deal to be said, because it's not only a press release they put out, but a 100-page report written up by a group of quite eminent scientists, most of whom are actively engaged in geoengineering, in geoengineering research, I should say, and who are actively lobbying for experimentation on our world. So maybe we should just draw back for a minute and see what it encompasses, geoengineering, because frankly most people don't have any idea. Is a variety of technologies. I'd say there's about a dozen that are under active discussion. This includes things like shooting sulfates into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back, so it doesn't actually reduce the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It merely reflects back the sunlight, so you don't have the effect of global warming. It includes things like ocean fertilization, dumping iron particles or urea or various other particles into the ocean to try and stimulate the growth of algae, which also absorbs carbon dioxide and then theoretically would sink to the bottom of the ocean where the carbon dioxide, the excess carbon dioxide, would be safely stored. It includes things like giant carbon-sucking machines that would draw the carbon out of the air, either at the point at which it's emitted or subsequent to that. Cloud whitening, you talked about. Again, that's what's known as an albedo-enhancing technique, something to make the surface of the Earth a bit whiter so that sunlight gets reflected back. But all of these schemes have potentially disastrous environmental and social consequences, and for that reason, the Etc. Group has been a pretty consistent voice in urging extreme caution while we look at these ideas, and we find some of the recommendations of the Royal Society report extremely dangerous.
You know, it seems like we want to trust the Royal Society, and yet I look to James Lovelock has said that as few as 8% of humanity would survive by 2100. He said that on The Hour, a CBC radio program. And Martin Rees has written a book in 2003, Final Warning, giving us just a 50-50 chance of surviving at all. I'm wondering why this sudden rush to geoengineering, and can you explain that?
Well, I think, actually, to be fair, certainly Lovelock has written a number of very critical things about geoengineering, and neither him nor Martin Rees are men that are easily given into a quick technological fix. And, you know, James Lovelock at the press conference, probably rather unpredictably to the Royal Society, said that he found these schemes Kafkaesque, which isn't exactly a ringing endorsement of them. But I guess the biggest card that the geoengineering lobby has in its pocket is this need for a plan B. You know, it's this idea that we're not getting on with changing our lifestyles and reducing carbon emissions and passing laws and regulations that will change fundamentally what we're putting into the atmosphere. And for that reason, these people are saying we need a plan B. And that's one of the major arguments that is being used in the Royal Society report, as well as by a bunch of right-wing think tanks like Bjorn Lomborg's group, the Copenhagen Consensus, like the American Enterprise Institute, Heartland Institute, the Cato Institute. All of these groups that have big connections to big oil, historical connections to big oil, and who have in the past been very active in the climate deniers camp. I mean, one of the authors of the report that Lundberg's group just put out is Lee Lane. Well, he was advising George Bush on climate change, and we all know what happened there. So, you know, but the odd thing is that in addition to these sort of extremist right-wing groups who are advocating these kind of technologies and say it's going to be a quick fix and it's going to allow us to keep on living and the environmentalists are all wrong, you now have a fairly significant group of what seem to be more moderate scientists who, in despair of our failure to address global warming at the multilateral level, have begun to advocate these technologies as well. Our view is that that's extremely naive.
Once these genies come out of the bottle, it's going to be pretty hard to control them. I was just reading about a U.S. military research wing, DARPA, held a geoengineering meeting this past spring, and Ken Caldera, who's been a reasonable voice but saying we need a plan B, was trying to, he says, persuade the military not to get into it, because who's going to stop someone from using these techniques to punish another nation, to withdraw their rainfall, to wreck their crops or something like that?
Well, absolutely, and some of the, you know, some of the measures that are being contemplated, we know, will have major impacts on precipitation patterns, and we also know that regional impacts will be different. You can well put sulfates up in the atmosphere over the Arctic and have the actual effects be felt in the heart of Africa, because you can't contain them. And the other thing that's very dangerous that's been part of this whole discussion, I mean, on the one hand, it sounds ever so reasonable to people to, we're just going to do more research. We're just going to, you know, find out if it's possible. And we're just going to engage in little small-scale experimentation. But when you're talking geoengineering, they are, by definition, large-scale technologies. These are not technologies that are employed on the local level at all. And there's universal agreement. The people who oppose Etcetera Group most and who are the strongest advocates of geoengineering would also agree with that, that is, by definition, their large-scale intentional manipulation of the Earth's climate. So you can't really experiment them on a small scale. The moment you're out of the lab and into the ocean or into the skies, you're experimenting on the one Earth that we have. And so we believe there will always be a pressure to go to larger and larger scale. And, I mean, the real problem behind all this is, who's going to make the decisions? Who's going to make the decisions? Who's going to control the technology? There's been very little discussion of geoengineering at the multilateral level. There was a discussion at the Convention on Biological Diversity, and there was one at the London Protocol on dumping in the ocean. But that was just over a very, very specific case of ocean fertilization. And, you know, we got, for example, a moratorium on ocean fertilization adopted at the Convention on Biological Diversity by 191 states in May 2008, and it was subsequently violated. So the moratorium didn't actually have enough teeth to impose its will. And in our view, the discussions about who's going to control the technology, whether or not we would want to ever deploy it, and what kind of regulation it's going to come under, all of that needs to happen before we start allowing these experiments to go ahead.
Well, sure. I mean, who could stop the United States or Russia or any country from launching mirrors into space, thus dimming the Earth for all life, and they could do it unilaterally after some climate disaster?
This is absolutely true. The potential for unilateral deployment is huge. And so there needs to be an international treaty that governs these technologies, would be our view, with real sanctions for those who violate its premises. It's just inconceivable. Not only could the United States or Russia decide to do that, an individual, a very wealthy individual, could actually decide to do this, start messing with the climate.
Wow. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Diana Bronson of the ETC Group. We last talked with ETC about the company Planktos, where an individual named Russ George was selling carbon credits, which were never realized, incidentally, while setting up a ship to dump iron in the ocean, supposed to fertilize an algae bloom and soak up extra carbon. Fortunately, I think, for the oceans, Planktos went broke before it disturbed the sea. But I want to ask you, Diana, are you seeing other companies in the wing hoping to get big government grants to start new climate-busting industries?
Well, I haven't done exhaustive search on that. There are most definitely other ocean fertilization companies, and there are companies just waiting to get a piece of the research money that's going to go ahead. One of the alarming recommendations in the Royal Society report is that there would be a voluntary code of conduct for research scientists from the public and private sector that would adopt this. I mean, it's called a code of practice. So it's, you know, it's got no more legitimacy than a corporate code of practice that would be applied to mining or to any other sector. As we all know, if you know, the companies who are engaged in the practice themselves sit down and write the code, it's not going to be very strong. It's not going to be very binding. It's not going to create any, not going to have any real penalties attached to it. Of course, there are profound connections between the energy industry, the chemical industry, the defense industry, and these geoengineering plans. Just prior to the Royal Society report being released, there's a virtually unknown think tank called NOVIM, based in California, I believe, that issued a report on this sulfates in the stratosphere idea, which they call solar radiation management, or SRM. And that study group was actually convened by the chief scientist of British Petroleum. And they have a research partnership with Princeton to look into some of these technologies. Now, he, Steve Koonin is his name, is now one of Barack Obama's key advisors on energy policy. So, you know, these are very powerful men who move in very small circles and who manage to get their views and their friends' views published in very credible papers, and those ideas then get circulated. Even Lomberg's group, I think you know, met with some senior advisors in the White House last week. Now, of course, the White House can meet with whoever it wants, and you know, it's perfectly normal that they'd be listening to all kinds of ideas. I'm not sure, however, we'd be able to get a hearing with them. There's a real interest in the part of the oil companies to exploit this whole new area, that's for sure.
And, you know, the corporate media is just picking right up on it. There's been some grand articles about how all this is going to work, with pictures of the sailboats that will go on forever, unless, of course, we have a little problem. And no questioning, no coming back to another scientist, or very seldom saying what are the real risks. So I feel the public isn't being informed. I mean, here are people who are actively discussing making the sky white instead of blue. And I think if we just ask the average person on the street, they haven't been consulted.
No, they haven't been consulted, and generally they don't even know about it. The whole discussion really does take place in quite elite circles. For the most part, it goes on in invitation-only meetings. That's beginning to change because the key scientists that have been involved have realized that that functions to their disadvantage. So they're now on an active campaign to get these ideas mainstream, to get them talked about in the media. And really the launch of the Royal Society report was very, very key in that regard. However, if you look at the media coverage of the Royal Society report in terms of its key messages, it was very, very confused. You had headlines that were completely opposing one to the other. You know, you had, on the one hand, something like Reuters saying, you know, world must plan for climate emergency, and then you had the London Times saying that geoengineering could cause a disaster. So you had completely contradictory headlines coming out of it. And that's largely because of the very careful marketing that went into it, the very careful things that were said. One of the mantras that is always said by the geoengineering lobby is that this should not compete with carbon emission reduction strategies. But that's, it's just so incredibly naive to think that if politicians think they have a solution, a techno fix to climate change that's, you know, going to allow them to get off the hook in Copenhagen, that they're not going to use that and that they're just going to go ahead and reduce their carbon emissions anyways. It's just, you know, really extremely naive to think that that's going to work.
What are your recommendations for governments or for citizens who don't want technologists to change the sky?
Well, I think we really have to work to democratize the debate. So therefore, we have to talk about it. We have to let people know that this is happening. And of course, anybody can go on our website, and we've got several reports on it, etcetera group.org. That's etcgroup.org. There's not enough discussion, I think, in the environmental movement and in, you know, associated movements about what is going on, which means that, you know, 95% of the talk about it is actually pro-geoengineering talk. We also need to set up some kind of a governance process around it. And in my opinion, that should not be under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, because it would be better to have it in the Commission for Sustainable Development or the Convention on Biological Diversity, or at least jointly with multilateral bodies that have a mandate other than addressing global warming, you know, anybody with an environmental mandate understands the urgency around global warming, but are not ready to, say, sacrifice the ozone layer or the our biological diversity or, you know, species or all these other environmental goods that we have in order to bring down the temperature, that would have a more sustainable and holistic way to go about it. So we need to democratize the debate. We need to demand accountability from our governments, and we need to say that there should not be one public cent that goes into further research and experimentation before those discussions are had. And then, if we have an actual governance process that is set up, and that governance process, you know, through democratic means and open discussion in a UN body, decides that we better get to elaborating a plan B, so be it. But it shouldn't happen beforehand.
And I think we should have a lot of nonprofit groups and citizen activism putting the pressure on to bring this issue out. Have we missed something? Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners as we wrap up?
Well, I think maybe just one more point on the Royal Society report, which is related to that last point that you made, is really, you know, the public engagement was very, very poor on this exercise. They had a group of scientists work on this, well, along with a lawyer and one social scientist work on this report for a year, and they never held any public meetings with NGOs or others to gather input from the environmental movement, the indigenous peoples, the developing countries are completely absent from their consideration. So, you know, the results of that report point to the skewed nature of their process, and had they opened it up a bit more, they would have been more open to some of the concerns and perhaps have had a better report overall.
Right. I mean, the commons of the global environment belongs to us all, and I don't mean just people in the first world, but obviously every living human and the animals and the plants. So I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking geoengineering with Diana Bronson of the Etc. Group. You can find them at etcgroup.org. I want to thank you a lot, Diana, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, our special on geoengineering, human control of the biosphere. If you just tuned in, download the full program from our website, ecoshock.org. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We've heard from top climate scientist Alan Robach and from activist Diana Bronson from the ETC group that's been opposed to geoengineering for years. Now, there are two groups of humans you need to know about who are trumpeting the sudden need for geoengineering. The first gang are, I think, well-intentioned. They are top scientists who are not just worried. They are frightened at the rapid deterioration of our climate. Keep in mind, two German commercial freighters just went through the Northeast Passage. That is, they sailed from Vladivostok on the Russian Pacific coast right past and over all of Siberia to the Barents Sea and then on to Europe. That cuts 4,000 miles off the other shipping route through Singapore and the Suez Canal, with a reduction in shipping emissions, to be sure. The route has been sealed off by sea ice for tens of thousands of years. Now it's open, without even an icebreaker. Simple yachts owned by private people are already sailing the Northwest Passage across the top of Canada to Alaska. This year, the summer sea ice is the third lowest on record.
A new study in the journal Science says temperatures in the Arctic are the warmest they have been in 2,000 years, and they're blaming greenhouse gases and resulting global warming. Scientists said the Arctic should actually be colder than usual now because changes in the Earth's orbit are causing it to get less sunlight.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon just went to the Arctic to see for himself. He found open waters, a great melting. In a speech to the World Climate Conference, the Secretary General said, quote, "Our foot is stuck on the accelerator and we're heading towards an abyss." There's plenty of climate panic to go around. Given the low hopes for the coming climate treaty talks in Copenhagen in December, a collection of scientists are plotting Plan B, in case humans just don't adapt their energy system in time, in case you and I are too crazy or lazy to respond. Some of the scientists involved include well-known names in science. James Lovelock endorses geoengineering research. In the United States, Dr. Ken Caldera has briefed groups ranging from Google executives to the U.S. military. I accept most of these top scientists are trying to be good humans. I'm also aware of a tendency in Western science, especially men, to create big projects that can end up very badly, like the Manhattan Project. In fact, Caldera, who I do respect, works at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, which I hate because it's most famous for its secret nuclear weapons development. He sometimes sounds like that kind of mind culture. What we have is a network of scientists who propose solutions that could only be implemented by either a coalition of the world's big powers or by a single major power like the United States, Russia, or China, perhaps even unilaterally, without a vote or a voice.
Oh, you all talk big, but who here has the guts to stop me? Mm-hmm. Very well.
The scientists want big research money for starters, perhaps billions of dollars that will go to new institutions that they will direct. Humans are seldom free of interest. You know that. The awful twist is, we may need the science they develop. Who really believes North Americans are going to stop driving gas-guzzling cars anytime soon? Who really thinks China will stop building mega-coal plants? Science to kill us? Science to delay our extinction.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. The Freemasonry of Science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
There is a second group of geoengineering cheerleaders behind the curtains. They are the big oil, coal, and power companies, and countries like Saudi Arabia, who make billions every day we use their products. Every day we delay cutting CO2 emissions. I'm sorry to say, in my opinion, Bjorn Lomborg is connected to that dark carbon energy. His latest scientific-sounding report is co-authored by Lee Lane, a writer, publicist sort of guy with the American Enterprise Institute. The AEI is famous for denying climate change for years, but suddenly they say global warming is so serious we must go straight to geoengineering. It's no surprise to find that the American Enterprise Institute has received more than $1 million from ExxonMobil. Exxon's anti-warming longtime CEO Lee Raymond sat on the AEI board for years. There's a whole website devoted to uncovering unsubstantiated claims made by Bjorn Lomborg. and links to all the American right-wing think tanks, like the Heartland Institute, the Cato Institute, the Complete Collection. These guys have sponsored this photogenic, well-spoken Dane in his trips to America. Find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog entry for September 24th, 2009. Click the blog on our main page at ecoshock.org. Or just Google Lomborg Errors. It's at the top of the pile. Fascinating reading. I'm not out to demonize Bjorn Lomborg. In fact, I invited him to present his views on this show, and I would have given him and you a fair hearing. People who call Lomborg a traitor miss the point. Bjorn is just another player in the carbon drama. We're all players as we sidle up to the gas pumps for one more hit. Yes, there is an evil conspiracy of fossil barons to keep the world warming while they make more money. Here's just one example I found in Joe Rome's Necessary Climate blog at climateprogress.org. From Joe's blog, where AGW stands for Anthropogenic Global Warming, with humans as the cause, quote, Richard S. Courtney, British coal industry flack, is one such denier who spreads disinformation on various blogs. As Big City Lib informs us, Courtney recently made this remarkable admission. I am firmly convinced that dangerous AGW is not a problem and cannot become one. However, I do think the possibility of the geoengineering should be supported. My reason for this is a political ploy, and I explain it as follows. The politicians need a viable reason if they are back off from this commitment to the constraints of greenhouse gases without losing face. The geoengineering option provides the needed viable reason to do nothing about anthropogenic global warming now. Joe Rom compares this tactic to the nuclear industry, which kept promising new technology to store their deadly waste. It never came, but the plants kept churning out more radioactive blunk. Kind of like the Clean Coal campaign. It's all just smoke and mirrors to let us off the hook. We can keep our carbon addiction while daydreaming about the big save by science just before we go under. Ha ha, what a drama. Never mind that blocking out sunlight does nothing to stop the acidification of the ocean, threatening all ocean life. Our carbon pollution will just keep rolling into the seas, killing off coral and all shell-making plankton and all the layers of life that depend upon them. That's not even mentioned in most of the popular press articles Lomborg pumps out through project-syndicate.org. The London Telegraph doesn't mention any side effects at all. Oh yeah, and so-called solar radiation management might wreak havoc with world rainfall patterns as well. That's the other side of global warming. You could call it global wetting, except most of the extra water taken up in that warmer world will fall at the poles, while major crop areas will experience centuries of drought. Geoengineering could rearrange that rainfall even more, with very unpredictable consequences. You know, droughts, floods, extreme rainfall events, triggering mass starvation and mass migration. That's covered in a scientific paper released last spring, written by Gabriel C. Hegrel and Susan Solomon, titled Risks of Climate Engineering. The authors caution that climate shift is about much more than temperature. Maybe we could cool things off for a few years with geoengineering, maybe. But the precipitation changes are unknown until we try it all out on the unsuspecting species who share this planet with us. Derek Jensen, the deep green writer, often asks, what will it take before you're willing to fight for what's left of the Earth? I know for sure, if anybody turns my blue skies white, because the coal barons stalled real action, or we just couldn't get it together, I will take up arms. If we let that happen, there will be little left to live for. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm still hoping we will make it peacefully through the eye of the needle to keep the natural earth. You cut your emissions, and I'll cut mine. We'll dedicate ourselves to real solutions. We can't take this one lying down on the couch. Demonstrate you care on 350 Day. That's October 24th. 350.org for the action nearest you. Join me next week on Radio EcoShock to learn why some communities survive crises while others fall apart. Our earlier music, Never Turn Your Back Against Mother Nature, was by Neko Case, and now this is Shane Phillip.
Ooh, we gotta work together, gotta help each other, gotta make each other better. That's what this life's for. Wanna see you.